Good afternoon. So, last time, we covered things about bit manipulation operations. We started by talking about bit shifting, which is a way to move bits left and right in a register. And we learned that that has this nice relationship to dividing or multiplying by a power of 2. There was this decision we had to make. Because when we were moving bits left and right, we still had to put them in a register of the same size. We need to decide, what do we do with the extra bits, the bits we moved out of the way? And for left shift, this was straightforward. We put in zeros because zero is kind of a nice default value, and it also makes it equivalent to multiplying by a power of 2. And for right shift, we had two different answers depending on whether we wanted something which made more sense with sign values, in which case we went to copy the sign bit, and we learned that that made the right shift the same as dividing by a power of 2 with particular rounding. That might not be the rounding we want. Or with unsigned numbers, we wanted to add zeros, which would make it, again, like dividing by a power of 2 with particular rounding. So bit shifting let us move bits around. We also wanted to do things where we did things to individual bits in our registers. And we had these bitwise operators to help us with that. These operators which treat their operands as an array of bits and did some sort of operation, typically on each pair of bits, because typically we would have two operands. So you do something on the ones place of the two operands, then the twos, then the fours, and so on. We're thinking about them as a binary number. And to think about, well, how do I do some sort of useful operation with these operators, where I have particular bits in mind, we can construct what I call the mask, where we put a 1 or a 0 depending on whether we want to do something with a particular bit. So we put a 1 in the places where they're the bits we want to, say, select are, and a 0 otherwise. And we learned that if we think of each of the operations in terms of what they do when you use a mask, we have, for example, the AND operation we can think of as extracting bits or clearing bits. We have the OR operation we can think of as setting bits that we select with that mask and leaving the other bits unchanged. We can think of the XOR operation as flipping bits we select with that mask and leaving the other bits unchanged. And this allows us to go from sort of a description of what we want to do with bits to an actual use of these operators. And we saw some examples of that with the lab yesterday and lecture. We started talking about, well, we went over these sort of bit puzzles. You have some for homework. We went over some strategies for solving them. And the big thing was finding subproblems, that if you want to do something complicated to all the bits of a number, think of something simpler you can do and build up from that. And we saw that example with building up this ternary operation, that using these bitwise operators to basically do an if statement without an actual branch. We built that up from doing it first for one-bit numbers only and then working our way from there. And our first topic for today is going to be another example of a very common strategy you'll see in these bit puzzles that comes up in a bunch of scenarios where you want to do bit manipulation. But before we get on to that, we don't know what we ended on last time. I want to emphasize again that I'll take any questions people have about things we covered before. But no, it was about sort of the actual implementation of these. So you think, AND is very simple, and we think of addition as simple, but ending that bitwise AND, that's actually way simpler than addition. So you'd think reasonably, well, it's going to be faster, right? Of course, it's just simpler in the hardware. And that makes sense, it's simpler in the hardware, but it turns out it's not usually faster. And that's not because we can't have hardware which does ANDs faster than ADDs. Like, that's kind of naturally how hardware works. But the people who designed processors said, well, gosh, I really need to do ADDs. And I really, really care about doing ADDs much more than I care about doing ANDs, because my programs that I run are doing a whole lot more ADDs than ANDs. So because of that, they're typically roughly the same performance, not because ADDs are really simple, but because people who make processors really care about ounce. So before I move on to another example of a tactic for bit puzzles, questions about things we covered last time. Yes. Question, in my last lecture, I gave examples of how many cycles different operations take. Do you need to know that? No, you should look it up if you need it. I just gave that as an example of this sort of efficiency not being maybe what you'd guess. Other questions? Yes. So the AND instruction does a bitwise AND. The ADD instruction adds two numbers together. And if you're taking 20 through 30, you might know that doing the operation of adding two numbers together basically involves doing something like a bitwise and other stuff. So it seems like bitwise AND should be slower. But if you actually try to write a program which does like a billion ANDs and a program which does a billion ADDs, you'll find out that they run about the same speed on a typical processor. And that's just, that's not because the ADD is really simple, it's because of the design, the priorities of the processor designers. Does that make sense? So do we still prefer doing bitwise AND? So if they're the same speed, you should do whatever makes more sense for what you're trying to do, right? But that means you, so I guess the thing I was trying to get at is that that means that if you find a way of like using a bitwise AND, an XOR, and an OR to do something that you could do with two ADDs, do the two ADDs. You know, that sort of trade-off. But if you have something where doing a bitwise AND makes sense, use a bitwise AND. Other questions? Okay. So to talk about some other things which come up in these bit puzzles, which also are going to give us a little insight into sort of the difference between how we might think about things in software and what's available to the hardware, I'm going to go back to the problem we had earlier. So when we were talking about that ternary operator puzzle, we needed a way of turning a number into 0 or 1, basically, based on whether it was true or false, whether it was 0 if it was 0, 1 otherwise. So turning 7 into 1, 6 into 1, anything but 0 into 1. And in lecture, we mentioned the solution of using the logical negation operator. And in lab, if you did the Bang problem, you had a solution that involved using the addition operator. And both of these kind of feel like cheating, because the logical negation operator is using a circuit that's dedicated to checking if a number is 0, probably. You know, if we have that, why are we bothering? And addition is way more complicated than checking if a number is 0. So let's think about how we can do this with our bitwise operations without the logical negation, the Bang operator, and without addition or subtraction, which is going to be closer to what the hardware implementation of that check if a number is 0 circuit is going to look like. And to work on this problem, I'm going to go back to a strategy I had before, which is let's start with a simpler subproblem, a simpler example of this problem. And I'm going to use the same strategy of restricting the size of my numbers. So I'm going to say, let's say x is 4 bits. I want to see if x is 0 or not, which is the same as saying, is any bit of x set to 1? Because if any bit set to 1, it's not 0. And so my strategy for doing that is going to be, I'm going to check if the ones place is 0 or 1, and I'm going to check if the twos place is 0 or 1, and I'm going to check if the fours place is 0 or 1, and I'm going to check if the eights place is 0 or 1, and I'm going to OR those together, because if any of them are true, I want a result of 1, otherwise I want a result of 0. So here's my solution written out for that. So the first part here, x ended with 1, extracts the ones place, and it's already 0 or 1, I'm done. For the next part, well, I want to check the 2's place, so I'm going to move the 2's place to the 1's place because I want an answer of 0 or 1 in the 1's place bit. And I'm going to end with 1 to get rid of everything else and just get that single value. And so on for all 4 bits. So questions about how this solution works? Okay, so here I have a viable approach, and if I had a 64-bit X, I could do this approach. It just seems like maybe this we could do better than that, because this seems awfully big. And so we're going to talk about a way where we're not going to use quite so many operations. And to do that, we're going to identify places where we're doing redundant work. There's a couple types of redundant work. We're going to start with the simplest one, which is that there's something we're doing here, which we're basically doing something multiple times at the beginning when we could be doing it at the end. So the operation we're doing kind of for each subpart is we're extracting only the last bit, because I only care about that one bit result, that 0 or 1 of that bit. So I have, in each of these examples, I'm ending with 1, ending with 1, ending with 1, ending with 1. And what I could do instead is I could say, let's not do that yet, and do that at the very end. Because if I OR all the bits of x together with all the bits of x shifted over 1, I'm going to get the same thing in the 1's place. Yes, the 2's and 4's places are going to have some sort of junk in them. But that's fine, because I can get rid of that junk by clearing all the other bits at the end, by ending with 1. That's a mask that says keep only the 1's place. So that gives me a solution like this. So I just move that, remove all but that 1's place operation to the end, observing that I was redundantly doing it early when I could just do it once at the end. And this sort of thing comes up a lot when you're looking at things like these bit puzzles, where you know the straightforward solution, you'll do something for each subproblem, but you can actually move it later. So questions about why this works? So I've gotten rid of some redundant work, but there's a bigger source of redundant work that we're going to look at, and that has to do with what these bitwise ORs do. So if we're thinking of working with 4-bit numbers, each of these bitwise OR operations, each of these pipe characters, represents not doing one OR, but doing 4. Because remember, our bitwise OR operation does every pair of bits. And in a typical hardware, we probably actually have 4 pieces of hardware that do an OR operation. And what we're doing is we're doing all 4 of those OR operations, and then at the end, we're throwing away the results of all but the one on the rightmost side. All the others, we're computing them, and we're ignoring those results. And we'd like to avoid that, because it would be really nice if, when we do this single OR operation, we can get more out of it, right? We're getting 4 bits of result. Can we use the other bits in some useful way? Or can we arrange such that when we do that OR operation, the other bits are useful? So for this problem, one thing I'll examine first is, well, what are we computing in those other bits? So to think of that, let's look at our first OR operation, x OR with x shifted over 1. In this case, I've written out the bits of x, so x sub 0 is the least significant bit of x, x sub 1 is the second least significant bit, and so on. So we're ORing x sub 3, x sub 2, x sub 1, x sub 0, that's the x written out in bits, with 0, x sub 3, x sub 2, x sub 1. And bitwise OR, we do each column. So our result, which I'm calling y here, has these 4 bits. And right now, we're only caring about the least significant bit of that, x sub 1 ORed with x sub 0. But ultimately, What we want to compute is x sub 3, or with x sub 2, or with x sub 1, or with x sub 0. We want to compute all the bits or together. And originally, we were doing that by extracting x sub 0, oring it with x sub 1, extracting x sub 2, and oring that with it, and extracting x sub 3 and oring that with it. But something which seems awfully convenient here is that we're already computing the other half of what we want, that x sub 3 ored with x sub 2. That's something that we're going to compute again in the ones place later, but we're already computing it here. We just discard that value right now. And if we weren't already computing it, maybe we could have moved bits around in advance to make sure we were computing it. But in this case, we got really lucky. Maybe not lucky, but things work out in this case that, it's already there. And the actual result we want is x3 or with x2 ordered with that first bit. So a strategy I can use to compute this is I can say, okay, so once I do that first OR operation, let's combine that value I have in the fours place with the value I have in the ones place in the same sort of way I combined the value in the ones and the twos place originally. So I'm going to shift over by 2 and do a bitwise OR. And you can see here, I'm still actually doing a bunch of bitwise operations that I don't care about. I'm computing a value in the twos place that might be useful, but I'm not using it. And I'm computing values in the fours place I'm not using. So maybe I could do better, but here I've saved a bitwise OR operation and I'm still computing the same result I was originally. I'm doing this sort of tree idea where fanning in the result. And this is probably actually similar to what the hardware structure for doing a checking if something is zero would look like. You'd have things happening in parallel like you're seeing here, and fanning into one result, like in that tree structure. So questions about this strategy? Yes? So the grayed-out operations are operations we used to do but haven't by using the tree method? No. So these are all things we're computing in the tree method. So all the grayed-out values we are computing, the grayed-out values are values we aren't using. And originally, the grayed-out values would have been, there would have been more of them, and we would have been doing more operations. So sort of the benefit we've gotten is that previously, we weren't using this value, and now we are. And previously, we were doing this sort of operation more times. So we still have waste, we just have less of it. And the gray kind of represents the waste. Other questions? Okay, so since we have this strategy, we can write it out. So we have our x shifted over by 1, or together. So we're oring together all the pairs. We're oring together more than that, but that's the part we care about. And then shift over by 2 to or together the pair of pairs. And we can write this out like so in our bit puzzle format. So I get pairs or together everything else. And I've shown up top the values we actually care about, but remember, we're actually computing, since each of these is a bitwise OR, we're computing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 values we don't actually care about. There's extra bits that we discard. Questions about this C version here? Okay, so I've done this for 4 bits, And we can extend this strategy to more than 4 bits. So if I think about doing this with 8 bits, the same kind of principle applies, that if I do the XOR with X shifted over 1, I'm going to get X1 and X0, then X3 and X2, also X4 and X5, and so on. And I can do the same idea of shifting things over 2 to OR these pairs together. And I end up with this kind of Fanon tree structure. And here I'm showing us as doing it by everything with its neighbor, so shifted over 1. But I could have actually also arranged to do this in different order. So I like could have done, instead of doing X1 and X0 first, I could have like done a version where I do X0 and X4 and X1 and X5 and so on. I'm just had to choose something for my example, and I chose to start with by doing things that are next to each other. But regardless, I end up with this kind of tree structure where I'm shifting the values to align the parts I care about. And at the end, we can produce a final answer which combines everything together. As if we did that same strategy we started out with, where instead of doing, in this case, we have 1, 2, 3 bitwise OR operations, would have had 7 bitwise OR operations. So with these bigger numbers, we end up saving a lot more work. So questions about the generalization? So we can extend this all the way up to, say, 32 bits or 64 bits. And you might write it out as a solution like this. So here, the 32-bit version, I would have needed 31 ORs with my original strategy and 31 ANDs with 1. And I got rid of the extra ANDs with 1 by moving it to the end. So that eliminated 30 operations. And I churn my 31 ORs into 5 by using this kind of tree structure. Questions? Comments? Yes. Okay, so you say, here I'm using an unsigned int, so the shifts are logical shifts. And you're asking, wait a moment, what if I use arithmetic shifts, would I run into problems because of the values being shifted and not being 0? So if we think about what's happening here, that means that values like here and here and here and this 0 part here would change. But you'll notice that those are all grayed out because we don't end up using those values to compute our final 1-bit result. So it would not matter. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yes. So this method computes whether any of 32 bits are set. So it's an extension of what we had before. So if you remember, we had, so do you understand this method?
For the most part.
So this is doing any of 4 bits or set by first we shift over 1 to get OR together the 2 pairs in the ones and the fours place in binary. And then we OR those together by shifting over 2. And if we look at this method here, if I got rid of these 3 lines here, it's exactly the same as that other method. So I'm just adding the step of, because I have more than 4 bits, once I OR together those pairs of pairs, I actually have a value in the ones place and the 16s place. The 16s place comes from the next 4 bits, and so on. And so that's why I have these shifting over by 4 to deal with those values. And then I'm going to realize, I have a value in the 1's place and the 256th place by a similar logic, and that's why I went 8 and so on. Does that make sense? And I guess I should emphasize that I chose to do, as I mentioned earlier, I'm doing pairs of bits that are next to each other, but we could have done this in a different order, which would change this code slightly. Other questions, comments? I thought there was someone back there. Okay, so this idea of when we have a bitwise operator, oh, it actually computes multiple things, we should take advantage of that, that comes up a bunch. You're worried about making efficient use of bitwise operations, maybe some other operations the hardware provides. And we'll kind of see another view of things where one operation computes multiple things much later in the semester when we talk about vectorization. And some general notes about the bitwise problems before we do one exercise and move on from them. So when you're doing the puzzles, one thing I recommend is you said find subproblems. I recommend writing things down, you know, working things out by hand, not just typing code and submitting it and hoping it does something. Remember this idea of masking and shifting. So think, if I want to work with particular bits, you can use this very, very common pattern of select those bits with AND, shift them over to where you want them. Note this idea of removing redundant operations. And a very common way this happens is that distributive property. Like if we're ANDing to select a particular bit, you can do that later, and some other operations work that way. Do the general divide and conquer thing. And with the bit puzzles in particular, you have temporary variables, and if you're computing something twice, like, for example, our solution here to the ternary operation, we actually compute not x twice. So you can avoid that, save an operation, the way we're counting operations, and hopefully your compiler would have figured it out in normal case, but it probably... this ends up being more readable having temporary variables in general. So questions about these strategies? Okay, so let's do this exercise. So I went to swap. So I have a number. I wrote last and second to last. I really should have written the least significant and second least significant bit. So in the example, like U, V, W, X, Y, and Z represent the last bits of the least significant bits of our input. Asking which, if any of these, do that swapping operation. I'll give you a minute or two. I recommend writing things down. I certainly did solving this. Okay, who would like some more time? Okay, a few people, more than a few people. Okay. Okay, who needs more time now? Hopefully, for sake of time, hopefully we're far enough along that you've at least attempted the first few. Yes, okay, hopefully. Okay, so who thinks A is correct? Thinks B is correct? One. Okay, who thinks C is correct? Okay, how about D? Okay, so we have most people think C is correct. We have very small numbers of people thinking B and D are correct. So B and D are related, but not quite. C is the only correct one. And I'll go through how I approach these problems. So for A, I just write down sort of symbolically what the number looks like. So I say, let's say X has the bits U, V, W, X, Y, Z. Those are going to be the least significant 6 bits of X. I only wrote 6 bits because I'm hoping that only 6 bits matter, and if I discover more mattered, I write more down. But when I did this problem, I never found a case where it mattered what the other bits were. And so I look at what this first half does here, this first part of the OR, and first operation is that value shifted over 1, so that takes U, V, W, X, Y, Z, puts a 0 in the front, and then U, V, W, X, Y is left over. The Z gets shifted away. And then I AND with 1. 1 has the ones place set and nothing else, so that extracts the bit Y, making everything else zeros. That Y that was in this ones place here. So this first part of this expression gives us Y. That seems like progress. Like, we wanted to get Y in the last place and Z in the second to last place. But when we look at what the rest does, well, we have X AND with tilde 1. Tilde 1 is going to have ones in everything but the ones place. So it's going to keep all bits but the ones place, which is why we end up with UV, W, X, Y, 0 in my sort of tracking our number. And then we OR them together. So remember, ORing, we OR the ones place. So we OR Y with 0 to get Y. We OR 0 with Y to get Y again. Then we OR 0 with X to get X, and so on. So our result is that we've duplicated the second to last bit into the last place, which is related to what we wanted, but not quite. So questions about how do I figure this out? Reason through this problem. So for B, I did something similar. So I found, again, that this first part extracted our second to last bit, Y, and moved it into the last place. This operation here, this is kind of close to what we want, but there's a little bit of a mistake here. So first, we shift over to the left by 1. So we end up moving Z into the 2's place from the 1's place, and also everything else. And then we AND to, extract particular bits. But rather than extracting just that 2's place, we've extracted everything but that 2's place. And if only we didn't do that, this might work out. But we didn't. So we end up with VWXY00 instead of Z0, which is probably what was intended. But they made a mistake by accidentally using complement here. And for the rest, we take a complement of 3. 3 has the 2's and 1's place set, so it clears those 2 bits because we took the complement of it and did an AND and keeps everything else. And I can tell that this won't give me the right answer. One way I can tell is that I know the 2's place will have 0, OR with 0, OR with 0, which is 0, which is not what we wanted. Questions? How I reason through that? So for C, I have my first part, which again, like before, strips off the last 2 bits. And now my second part moves my Z to here. It does it by extracts the bit with Z by ending with 1 and shifts it over by 1. So I get Z in that set 2's place and nothing else set. And this last part, I shift the number over, so I move my Y, my second to last bit, to the last place, and then I AND to actually extract only it. I OR these together, and I'll get the right result. I have 0, OR with 0, OR with Y, gives me Y in the last place. 0, OR with Z, gives me Z. OR with 0, gives me Z again, in the second to last place, and so on. So that gives me the right answer, and for version D, this again was kind of close, which is probably what people. So we have this first part moves Z into the second to last place, which we want. This part here, we extract YZ and then shift over by 1. So we get rid of Z and move Y into the last place, which is what we want. But then we XOR. And XOR doesn't do the right thing. So we have these two first values OR together. So I get ZY. But ZY XORed means that, for example, our ones place is going to be Y XORed with Z rather than just Y. So that's why that's not correct. Some questions on any of these explanations? Clear enough? Okay. And I note that I could have written that code much more clearly. And I advise doing this on the bit puzzle assignment. So that's everything on bit manipulation. So our next topic is going to be instruction set architectures. So instruction set architectures are, you know, like related to assembly languages and kind of the machine code. And there's a lot of them. So even just things that people actually make today, there's still a lot of them. And you might say, oh, everything runs x86. And well, yes, x86 is very dominant in desktops and servers, and there's some ARM, but ARM is, and has been for a while, like the dominant platform for, say, mobile phones. And maybe you say ARM is more important. But a whole bunch of other things. Instruction sets are out there. You might say, so what's different about them? Why would people have constructed these different instruction sets? Why don't we just need one? So we're going to look at sort of what goes into the design of these and what sort of design goals they might have and what different decisions have been made across these many different instruction sets. And one thing you might observe at the beginning is, well, these are targeting different types of machines, so maybe that influences the different decisions. Now, we're going to talk about instruction sets, and it's a term we've used a bunch, but we want to distinguish it from just everything about a processor. So we're going to have the term microarchitecture to refer to the design of some hardware, like a processor. And the instruction set is the interface that's visible to software. So what matters for software compatibility. And we can have the same instruction set implemented very differently by different processors. So for example, the instruction set that was implemented on x86 processors in the mid-90s is still supported on modern x86 processors, even though the microarchitecture, the design of that hardware implementation, is extremely different. Or even today, like for example, Intel manufactures a different microarchitecture for things like laptops and desktops than they do for chips they make targeting really low power applications, because they decided that, you know, even though we might be implementing the same software interface and running all the same software without changes, you know, we want to have different hardware to use really little power versus to have the performance you expect on a laptop or desktop. So the instruction set is that software visible interface. So with that definition in mind, look through these. Which of these changes would be changes to the instruction set of a processor? If I had one processor and then made this change, in which cases would I be changing the instruction set? Give 30, 40 seconds. Okay, so who thinks A would be a change to the instruction set? A would be a change, increasing the number of registers available in assembly, change to the instruction set. Okay, a couple. B, increasing the runtime of the add instruction. C, making the machine code for add instructions shorter would be a change to the instruction sets. Okay. D, removing a multiply instruction. Okay, pretty good consensus there. E, allowing the add instruction to have two memory operands. Okay, so let's go through in order of where we had the most consensus. So removing a multiply instruction, indeed, is a change to the instruction set. And that's because, well, we changed what programs could run. Yeah, on the processor. And in a pretty obvious way, there's probably going to be a bunch of code that you've compiled that won't work anymore because it uses a multiply instruction. And I think the next two most common were C or E. I'll start with C. So the software interface includes the machine code. So if you change the format of the machine code, that's a change to the instruction set. So this is an instruction set change. You can't use the same software and the same compiler. That's what the compiler does as part of that interface on that after that change. So that is an instruction set change. Because I would need a new compiler after I did that. And E is the same way. So something which trips people up is that usually you think of these changes as, oh, I made a new, it's backwards compatible, right? I'm just adding more features. But it's a different instruction set if the interface is different. So if you have more things you can do in that interface, it's still a different instruction set. It may be compatible in one direction, but that doesn't change that. So we don't care that it's backwards compatible. Like, if I have software written for the new processor that uses add instructions that have memory operands, it won't work on the old processor. So it's this instruction set change. I've changed the software interface. Okay. And thus we have A and B. So increasing the number of registers available in assembly. So this would be another case where I think people were thinking, oh, this is backwards compatible. Like, I can do it in a way where I can still run programs written for the old processor, but we care in both directions. If the software interface is more capable, it's a different instruction set. So this is an instruction set change. So if your assembly, instead of having R8 through R15, has R8 through R20, that's an instruction set change. Because it changes what assembly is allowed, what changes what machine code is allowed, and what it does. Decreasing the runtime of the add instruction. This is the only one which is not an instruction set change. So we don't consider performance part of our instruction set. That's sort of an attribute of our implementation. You know, just that it produces the right answer is what we care about. Yes? So the question is, you thought this was just a hardware change. So the key phrase here is available in assembly. So if I was only talking about changing the number of registers that you couldn't actually access from machine code or assembly, wouldn't matter. You're correct. But if they're available in assembly, that means that my instructions, instead of like referring to, you know, R15 and lower, can now refer to like R20 and R30 and lower. And that's a change to the software interface, right? It changes how we write assembly, how we write compilers for this processor versus the other processor, right? We have different capabilities. Other questions, follow-ups? Yes. Can I explain E again? So for E, we're changing what add instructions are allowed, which means that basically we've changed what the add instruction does. It's true that our new add instruction does strictly more, but this means that I have a program for the new processor, it won't work on the old. They have different instruction sets, namely different software interfaces. They support different software. Other questions? Yes. If I need to have a For E, so an indication of instruction set change is if two processors have the same instruction set, I should be able to take a program on one and run it on the other, or vice versa. For E, that would not be true, right? If I have a program which uses this feature, I can't run it on the processor which doesn't have that. But if we consider B, for example, if I have a processor where ads are slower, I can certainly run programs where ads are faster, rather. I can certainly still run programs in the processor where ads are slower. Your question? So it's changing the way caches work in instruction set change. And the answer is generally no, because it doesn't change what programs can run. It just changes how fast they run. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we've thought about what is an instruction set? So what are some goals I should have in mind when designing an instruction set? So tell me something that should be a priority if I was in charge of designing an instruction set, something I should try to do. Yeah. So Turing complete. So yeah, we want it to be able to do things. And probably stronger than that, we want it to be, convenient to, compute things in, not just sort of accidentally able to compute things, like many examples of minimal Turing complete languages. Yes?
Make it readable.
So readable assembly?
Yeah.
So it should have a readable assembly language. Okay, other things? Other priorities we might want to have? Yeah.
Reasonable speed.
So it should be, the speed isn't an attribute of the instruction set, but it should be possible or easy to have a fast implementation. Okay. Other, yes. Convenient to compute things in. Sorry. My handwriting is very bad. Yes, that is convenient. Maybe missing a few letters. Okay, other properties we want. So not seeing any. So let's think about this. And note that we have some goals that might be in conflict here. So making it convenient to compute things, making our assembly readable, and therefore probably meaning that our instructions do lots of useful things, might mean that we have to make some compromises that might mean our implementation isn't as fast as we might like in order to achieve those goals. And we're going to see sort of examples of that conflict. Now that we've talked about sort of high level goals, do you have a question? So Turing complete. So someone mentioned we want our assembly language to actually let you compute anything. And Turing complete is, if you take 3102, is what you'll learn is a mathematical definition of able to compute anything. Yes. So the question is, for this last goal of wanting to make it possible or easy to have a fast implementation, are we going to take into account what sort of hardware design we have in mind? Yes. So often, instruction set designers will have a particular microarchitecture in mind, but doesn't mean that's what you have to use. And obviously, for x86, the original version of x86 had a completely different microarchitecture in mind than modern x86 processors. But that is something that's likely to be an aspect of that. Other questions? So we've looked at this sort of high-level goals we might have. And one way we can look at instruction sets is we can look at sort of just easily found attributes of them. So here I've extracted sort of three kind of very important high-level ideas of choices instruction sets make. So one is how long instructions are in machine code. So the machine code for an instruction, including its operands. So in some instruction sets, it's going to be variable length. In some, it's going to be fixed length. So in x86-64, instructions in machine code range from 1 to 15 bytes. In YD664, which is the what you're going to implement, that's a subset of x86-64, they're 1 to 10. And there's a bunch of instruction sets where they said, well, that's complicated. Let's just have them be fixed length. And when you made that decision, you might think, well, they're probably making that decision to make the hardware easier to implement. But it might make the assembly more complicated. It might make it less readable. Because if your instructions are 4 bytes, you can't put a 4-byte constant in your instruction. Another decision is how many, what I call normal registers, general purpose registers like RIX, R8, RNANG, and so on, we have. So obviously the hardware needs to provide this, and you know, if you provide more, that's gonna maybe require more hardware, but be more useful for assembly programmers. If you provide less, as a maybe simpler implementation. And you can see that we have sort of our usual consensus values are like 16 or 32-ish registers these days, and some outliers here. So we have some very older constrained systems that use a lot less. We have Itanium, which is just weird in every way. And another big choice is like just how many instructions do we implement? And I have a prox here because counting instructions is weird. So for example, in x86, is the 64-bit and 32-bit add, are they different instructions? Well, it depends who you ask. So this is one count of them. And I count x86 has like 1,500 instructions in its modern variation. And in contrast, you might have much smaller instructions, like the Z80, commonly used on like TI-83s. Or the one we'll be implementing will have 18. And obviously that, you know, is kind of a trade-off between how easy is it to implement. You know, if you're implementing 1,500 instructions, that's a lot of work. Versus, you know, sort of how maybe convenient it is for assembly and compiler writers. So questions about things on this chart? Yes. Is GNU an ISA? No, not that I'm aware of. I'm aware of definitions of GNU that are not ISAs, but not one that is. Other questions? Yes.
What's the Itanium used for?
So what's the Itanium used for? So back in the day, Intel had this idea that people who wanted to run servers, they wouldn't use x86 because that's silly. So they'd run Intel's fancy new architecture, the Itanium, which used the latest in computer architecture research in its design. It's a really nice design. Did something called very long instruction words that you might learn if you take a graduate computer architecture class. And it failed. Failed in the market basically because people preferred the 64-bit extension of x86 that AMD came up with. Or alternately, to be buying like machines from IBM's power line, and so on. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so there's some other choices that instruction sets make that show up a lot. So one is about condition code. So we learned about how condition codes work on x86, and there's a bunch of architectures that use that condition code idea, where we have this compare that sets condition codes, and then a conditional jump or some other conditional instruction that uses them. But this is not the only design, and it's actually pretty common to have instruction sets, which use another design where you'll have this instruction like branch of equal, which is what it would be on, for example, MIPS, which does the comparison and the jump in one instruction, and we don't have condition codes. So there's advantages and disadvantages to both approaches. We'll learn maybe why, much later in the semester, why sort of current architecture designs might prefer you to have this one. But you know, that's an instruction set design decision that has a pretty big impact on assembly that you have to make. Another big decision is what type of operands you have. So in x86, we've seen this weird displacement-based index scale. And that's a choice x86 made, and most other architectures have come up with other choices. And sometimes, you know, they allow some other things that might seem weird from an x86 perspective. Like, for example, ARM allows you to specify operands to instructions which include a bit shift. So just like in x86, you can specify an operand to an add instruction that's accessing memory. In ARM, you can specify an operand to an add instruction that does a bit shift first. Or VAX, for example, not only let you specify an operand to an instruction that was retrieved from memory, but let you specify one where you retrieved a pointer to the thing from memory and then use that pointer to actually retrieve the value. And you can see that, well, implementing some of these might increase hardware complexity, but might be useful for assembly programmers. And that's sort of a decision about which ones of these to provide is something instruction set designers need to think about. Like, what would our programmers or compilers like? Another very consequential choice is the number of operands. So having learned x86 assembly, you're used to instructions having generally two operands, a source and a source slash destination. And this means that if you like want to do x equals y plus z, and you want x, y, and z stored in different registers, you need to do an extra move. So some architectures have three operand instructions. So source one, source two, and destination. And from hardware, it usually turns out that it's basically as easy or easier to store the result of our arithmetic in a different register. But you might say, why would we not provide that instruction then? Well, if we provide the three operand instruction, that means all our instructions are longer. So there is a trade-off there, because now it means every single instruction needs to specify an additional register ID. And some architectures just couldn't decide, like VAX, which is an old architecture we'll talk about a bit more, decided, oh, we'll just provide both versions of the instructions. Why not? We can have some extra instructions. So questions about these choices are condition codes, addressing modes. So XJ addressing modes is the vocab term for ways of specifying an operand to an instruction. We probably haven't said that explicitly. So that's the jargon term you'll see written down. Yes? So question, having this extra operand. So the machine code is bigger. So we have it's slower in this. So having the extra operand means that we have to retrieve more machine code for each instruction. Though maybe we have to retrieve less move instructions. But it's easy in the sense of the hardware that the way register values are typically stored, we typically would be specifying separately the register to read and the register to write anyways. So that part is usually kind of free. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yes. So the question, one idea to avoid this problem to have like two versions of the instructions? Yes, that's what VAX did. So VAX provides both of these instructions with different names, obviously. But that means you have more instructions, which makes your hardware more complicated, which is a disadvantage. So we've talked about these minutiae of instruction set design. How many registers? How big are instructions? And so on. Do we use condition codes? But there's some sort of two big philosophies that historically dominated when people were coming up with lots of different instruction sets. And one of the most important ones is the reduced instruction set computer. So you might say, reduced from what? And I think to understand the reduced instruction set computer, this way of designing instruction sets, and this is something which came around in Berkeley and Stanford in the 80s, 70s, and they were reacting to the instruction sets of the time. So it's reduced from what? Well, it's reduced from what's commonly called CIS, complex instruction set computer. But what was complex at the time, what the instruction sets look like, is maybe more complex than you might be expecting by thinking, oh, x86 was really complex. They're complex in a very different way, in a much stronger way that they were reacting to. And VAX is kind of the canonical example of the heyday of the CISC design philosophy. So here are some real VAX instructions. I'll let you read over this for a bit. These are real VAX instructions. Yes, these are instructions. These are not macros. These are instructions you can write in assembly that have their own machine code. So we have matc, which is find a string in another string given the length of the two strings and their locations in memory. We have this poly instruction, which evaluates a polynomial of some specified size. We have editpc, which is basically a printf instruction. So these instructions seem not only complicated, but they like do loops. Like if you were implementing these as like a function, like this functionality, it would be non-trivial to debug. And this is where VAX landed. And you might say, wait, why was VAX building instructions like this? Another question you might have is, how was VAX implementing instructions like this, right? These seem like enormously difficult to implement using our simple hardware tools. And there was a very common strategy for hardware design at the time, which made this actually not that bad to implement. And that was something known as microcode. So basically, the way the typical VAX implementation worked is that it looked up this sort of second secret simple micro instructions for the VAX hardware based on the machine code. So there's this table of these micro instructions called microcode, which is a sort of secret, simpler, but more low-level instruction set that actually implemented these instructions, and that microcode could have loops and things like that, and that's why VAX could implement all these fancy instructions. And you say, that's great. And that meant, you know, that VAX was really convenient to write assembly code for. So it seems like a win, right? We have a relatively fast way of implementing them. That, you know, was our hardware strategy. So why did the RISC people react to this and say, no, let's stop having these instructions? And there were a couple things that arised from this approach. So one thing is that these instructions were not, often were not faster. You say, oh, there's an instruction for finding a string in another string. Of course it's going to be faster. But that instruction turns into these simpler micro instructions that actually run the like loop and such. And you're depending that the hardware designer wrote the fastest version of that and debugged that and shipped that. And if they got that wrong, that they'll hopefully somehow patch their hardware to fix it and make it faster. Whereas you could write that loop yourself. Yes, you need more machine code, so maybe that would be slower, but it might turn into basically the same operations, and if there's any sort of optimizations, you could do them as a, like a compiler writer or an assembly writer, but if you have this matc instruction, you don't really have that option. And even though we had this microcode strategy, implementing these complex instructions is still a lot of work because you have to build that microcode and debug it and make sure it works. And if it doesn't work, what do? You basically have to have someone go out to the people who have your computers and physically open them up and change the microcode. Or something like that. It's a lot harder than like fixing an OS that's broken. And another, and a bigger thing is that VAX was written for handwritten assembly, right? These instructions here, these are based on people are writing assembly. And at the time that RISC was becoming popular, compilers were starting to be trusted a lot more. The early compilers, often they produced not very good code. Sometimes they had bugs. People didn't trust them that much, but people were starting to trust them and starting to rely on compilers to generate assembly. And if you can rely on compilers to generate assembly, you can have this design philosophy that rather than focusing on making things convenient for assembly programmers, let's focus on making the hardware efficient. And that's what RISC focused on. So they said, let's make these design decisions that are going to allow for efficient hardware and rely on the compilers to generate code for that that works, not having people handwrite assembly. So they have fewer instructions that are simpler. They only want to implement the instructions that, you know, are going to be fast in the hardware and useful overall. They don't want to try to implement these complicated instructions. Let the compilers do that. They typically have separate instructions to access memory. So one way they simplify the hardware is they say, our arithmetic instructions, they're only going to use registers. And we'll have separate move instructions that move things to and from memory, and that's going to keep our hardware simpler. And to make up for that, they have more registers. How can they afford to have more registers? Well, you just saved a bunch of hardware by not implementing these complicated instructions. So let's use that for registers that the compiler can make good use of, hopefully. Yes? The question is, VAX is a complex instruction set architecture? Yes. They also tend to have fixed length instructions, since those are easier to implement and very few addressing modes. Very few ways to specify operands. Keep the hardware simple. Let the compiler worry about figuring out how to compute that, like memory addresses. Don't provide lots of ways of doing it. Yes, your question?
There are no CISCs that survive, right?
What?
There are no CISCs that survive?
That's a complicated question. So x86 is often considered a CIS architecture. It has lots of CISC-like features. It has complex addressing modes. It has lots of fancy instructions. But if you look at the implementation of x86 these days, often x86 basically runs these complex instructions by converting them to RISC-like instructions internally. Like, the implementation of modern architectures looks very RISC-like with some pre-processing phase above head. Okay. And I know I'm over time, so this is where I'll finish off. Just CISC-like, remember, is easier for the assembly. RISC-like is easier for the hardware by simpler instructions, you know, that are, we can implement efficiently in the hardware. We can focus on efficiency versus CISC, where we might care more about making the assembly convenient and short and so on.